Access number 28672, Mr. Tony Bradbury, Reel 10. Now, we're talking about your visit to South Africa aboard the HMS Vengeance. What happened next? You went to East London. Your aeroplanes, most of them are ashore, Pretoria, giving a display.
Yes.
Now, what happens next?
Well, we stayed in East London for 4 days. The intention was we were going to land there and have a look around that place. But because the weather was so bad, they didn't run any Liberty boats. So while we stayed at East London for 4 days, that was it, really.
We could see.
Well, we just turned tail and went back to Cape Town.
What happened next?
Well, more or less a repeat of what happened the first time. The same old people came down, the people that entertained us first of all, they came down to the ship again. They picked up with us again and looked after us very well. There were the usual few lonely old men, if you like.
So, but take the story along a bit, so I understand that. What do you do next, if you see what I mean? What does the ship do next?
Well, after Cape Town, we went back to St. Helena, where we went through the same procedure again.
So why had the ship gone out there?
I think, this is only my guess, to try and boost a loosening tie between Britain and South Africa. I think with the fall of the Smuts government and the advent of the Milan government, someone in this country had sensed that we were going to lose South Africa, as we did eventually in 61. And I think it was in a move to keep the tie strong that we went out in the first place.
So you're on your way back. You call in again at the same places, basically.
More in reverse, yes.
And where'd you come back to?
Well, first of all, to St. Helena. We stayed again there, left at Jamestown for a couple of days, and a few people from the ship. Again, I tried to get ashore there, but couldn't do so. And a few people from the ship land up Jamestown to return hospitality, or as guests, if you like, of the governor of St. Helena, who'd come on board as a guest of the ship. And after that, we went back to Sierra Leone, to Freetown again.
And where next?
Well, first of all, the weather was changing then. It was getting on late October, and the weather was getting bad. And we had a tragedy on board because on one of the Liberty boats, a bloke fell overboard, and the current was very strong in Sierra Leone Harbour. He got swept away. Well, with great courage, an officer who was on board the ship dived in and tried to rescue this man. Couldn't do so, but later on he got an award from the Royal Humane Society. He got their gold medal, I believe, later on for trying to rescue this man at great peril to himself. This particular officer was a very strong swimmer. And he dived in and, I say, made a successful attempt to rescue this drunken character who had fallen over off the Liberty boat when it got near the ship. And he got an award as a result of it. That was the main thing that I can remember about our visit to Freetown. Except, of course, the usual crowd came down and picked up acquaintance with us again and took us round and told us their usual tale of woe, how the ants were eating all their property and all that.
So same as before, yeah.
Same as before,
so
yes.
What happened when you got back to England then?
Well, back to England, we...
When November or still October?
Got back in late November, if my memory serves me.
So what was to happen next?
Well, we came back to Portland. And from there, all the air people disembarked and went off to RNAS Yeovilton.
Which would include you?
Include me, yes.
What happened at Yokon? What were you doing there?
Preparing for a visit to the Arctic, no less.
So, did that entail anything special?
Well, not very much. Instead of practicing for, shall we say, Atlantic or South Atlantic or Mediterranean flying, we had to prepare for Arctic flying. And what they wanted to do really was to see how well these light fleet carriers would operate under Arctic conditions. I don't think they hadn't had any wartime experience of them, so fairly early on at our stay in Yeovilton, we started to get some scientists from the various defence establishments come down, and they would tell us what we would be expected to do when we got up into the Arctic. One thing I remember, which was another failure, I believe, which was to spread a certain paste onto the leading edges of the aircraft to prevent them getting iced up, and thereby causing the aircraft not to fly properly. But I don't think that paste, which we eventually did spread on when we got up in the Arctic, I don't think it was very successful, because after time that was dropped as well. But it was just a matter of trying things out to see how they worked. So we stayed at the Yeovilton had Christmas leave at Yeovilton, came back, and towards the end of January, we re-embarked on the Vengeance and sailed off up into the Arctic.
And what do you remember about that trip?
Quite a lot. the weather was so changeable, it's hard to describe. We talk about a changeable weather in winter in England, but there, about midday, the weather would be calm, the sea would be perfectly blue, it would be cold, but a bracing sort of cold, and there'd be loads of ice around. But at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it would be blowing a hurricane. It would change as quick as that. So I say later on, I've got some photographs which I'll show you, but generally speaking, it was the most interesting time I'd had in the Navy.
Well, tell us a bit about it then. In what way?
Well, first of all, we had the bad weather to contend with. The ship, under the hurricane conditions, which used to blow up out of nowhere pretty well, would move around, and of course our mess being in the right of the bows, we would have a very great lift of about 50 feet, and then a terrific crash down into the water, and our mess would be underwater, because you could hear, we were under the cable deck, you see, we could hear the water rushing around on the cable deck until the next spasm, when the ship would lift again, and all the water would pour off the cable deck, which we'd hear pouring down the sides of the ship, and it would go like that for days, actually, sometimes. That was the most interesting part.
What else do you remember?
The cold, because I've never known the inside of a ship to get icy. They'd got things like actual messing sorted out a bit better than the first time round, but they hadn't, I don't think, allowed for the fact that on the inside bulkheads of the ship that were nearest to the sea, that ice would form. So that I found that sometimes we would get icy conditions on the bulkheads of the ship, of our mess. And that was a bit chilly, as you might well imagine. Fortunately, we had hammocks, and we had sufficient hammock space to deal with all the people on board or in our mess. But under those conditions, at night time particularly, one could not sleep. You just have to lie there and rest, really. And some people, the more highly strung ones, their nerves started to give way because they would, they'd be lethargic. They didn't want to work very much. All they wanted to do was lie all day and all night in their hammocks and perhaps stagger out to the heads to perform now and again. But that's all they wanted to do. And living conditions were a bit hazardous because I used to have to go into the pantry and try and get the mess stewards to serve breakfast or whatever meal it was, and that was with great difficulty. And things were a little difficult in compared to conditions further south.
Now, how did the flying go? You know, the tests on how the airplanes flew in these
conditions? Not very well.
In what way?
First of all, the business about the paste on the leading edges of the main planes, that had to be got rid of fairly quickly because I think they found, although they never said so, that it was altering the flow of air over the main planes and causing the aircraft to fly a bit erratically. So that had to be dropped very quickly. It was very difficult for aircraft to take off and land under those conditions because the aircraft carrier would move around like I've never seen anything move around before. So we didn't get much flying done. And we had a couple of fatalities.
What caused that?
Well, we had, by this time, the sea wars had gone out, which we'd had on the Venerable, and we got sea otters. And I remember on one occasion, when the weather was bad and the flight deck was icy, that was one of our duties to try and get the flight deck clear of ice so that aircraft could land more or less safely. This sea otter landed on, skidded on the ice, hit the crane which was above the funnel, went into the sea, and by that time we hadn't got helicopters attending aircraft carriers, we got destroyers. And I saw this chap, obviously he got knocked out, the pilot, and he was still sitting in the sea otter and he wasn't moving. I don't know if he's dead or just knocked out, but the destroyer came up but couldn't get him before the sea otter sank, complete with pilot. And also, we had a submarine with us on the trial as well. And one of the officers got washed out of the conning tower one night. So I think there were about 1,400 people all told, between two or three destroyers, the aircraft carrier, and the submarine. We had about 1,400 people. We lost two of them in a very short space of time, mainly entirely due to weather. It wasn't due to any action or anything like this, but they got lost on account of weather.
Now, how did you do the de-icing of the deck?
Well, we just had to scrape the ice off. Just had to...
What with?
Well, anything we could get hold of, really. We got improvised scrapers, and we used to scrape off the ice and clear off the snow if it only had fallen overnight. And just try and do the best we could, really. If the weather was so bad that we couldn't, the ice was forming again before we got it clear, they used to abandon flying for the day.
Now, anything else about this trip? It sounds quite as you say, quite a dramatic trip.
Well, it was there I learned really that distances at sea are very deceptive. Because I remember one of my friends saying to me, "That's Jan Mayen Island over there." So I said, "Yes." I said, and I've looked on the map, and one of the peaks is 7,000 feet high. He said, "How far do you think we are off it?" So I said, "Well, looking at as we are now, I think we're about a mile." Oh, you see, I don't think we're as far as that. I think we're only about half a mile off. So I said, "Well, we can settle it. We can go to one of the radar repeaters in the chart room and have a look and see how far it is." And when we looked at it, we found it was, we were 7 miles away. So I found out then for the first time that you can't rely on visual means of distances at sea, because they can be very deceptive.
Anything else you remember?
Well, eventually we got hold in the bows by some pack ice.
What happened? Do you remember it?
Yes. There was a big crash, and this was underneath our mess this time, in the bows. The area got flooded, and we had to have the shipwrights in to try and patch up this hole, which they did more or less. But we had to keep pumping out the water that was in this particular ship space, and this went on for some time. But after about 6 weeks, they decided they'd had enough of the trial. We got the scientists on board as well, of course, with all their various instruments, checking temperatures, checking how flying went, checking this pace they put on the leading edge. And eventually, it was decided that the trial had to come to an end. So about early March, we then came back down south and docked at Rosyth.
That was March 1949?
March 49, yes.
And what happened then?
Well, we weren't there very long. We still lived on board. But after a few days, they packed us off down to Cold Rose.
The flying people?
All the flying people, yes. I think all the ship staff, the seamen, the stokers, all the rest of it, they eventually paid off. And the one thing I remember about Rosyth was that the Nelson and Rodney were being chopped up there at the time. And I thought, well, is this the end of the battleship Navy?
And so the ship was paid off?
I think the ship was paid off. We left first of all, actually, and went down to a Cold Rose. And the ship was eventually paid off at Rosyth, and all the various ship staff, all the permanent staff, if you like, they got paid off and went back to barracks.
And what happened to you at Cold Rose?
Well, we did the same thing again there. We then transferred to the air staff at Cold Rose, and we did the same thing again there, usual stuff, DIs, repairs, monthly inspections, weekly inspections, all this sort of thing. The same routine as before, but of course under different people.
What happened next?
Well, eventually they dispersed us all from Cold Rose, and I went off to Leon Sonath again.
Now, what were you doing there? On the same duties? Or
same thing again, yes.
When was it Leon Solar then? When did you go to Leon Solar?
Roughly. I should think about late May, early June in 49.
What happened then?
Well, again, I got attached to the air staff down there, and did the usual routines. And there I managed to chalk up one of my greatest successes. One aircraft was, I was on duty that weekend, and one aircraft wouldn't charge up. As the pilot reported that the aircraft would not accept a charge of the batteries. And frankly, it was a type of aircraft I'd never worked on before, and I didn't know what to do about it. But the particular duty engineering officer, he was getting rather impatient. He said, "Why can't you solve this problem?" I said, "Well, just let me read the books on the aircraft for a little while, sir. I'll see if I can solve the problem." So eventually I looked at the books very hastily and found out that this particular aircraft was responsive to losing its initial magnetism on the batteries. Its initial magnetism on the body of the dynamo, so that it wouldn't charge the batteries. So I just thought, well, if I boost the field with some other batteries, perhaps that'll get it going. I had no idea whether it would or not, but fortunately it did. But I'm glad to say that was my greatest success. It was quite unexpected. I never knew if it was going to work, but it did. And the engineering officer was exceptionally pleased, which was a great relief to me, I can assure you. Because had it not worked, I'd have got it in the net.
So how long were you at Lee on Solent at this time?
Until I got demobbed in March 1950.
So a year?
Well, getting on for a year, yes.
Now tell me about the demobilisation process.
Well, first of all, when my time was coming to an end, I got called in for an interview with a commander. And he said to me, "Why don't you sign on?" And I thought, "Well, no, I've had enough of this lot, really." And I said, "No, I think I've had enough, sir. Thank you very much." He said, "Well, I can't blame you," he said, "but I wish you'd sign on." I said, "Well, I don't think I will." So I said, "Well, very well, I'll put you through the demobilisation routine." And they put my name into the demob section. And eventually, on March the 7th, as I remember, my day of active service in the Navy came to an end on March the 7th, 1950. And I went off to Woking, I believe. I handed in quite a bit of my service gear and got my demob suit, as it was called. Got a final payment of all the money that was owing to me, and then came home.
Now, what was the demob suit like? I mean, was it any good? Because we're always asking about this, because it's a joke, standing joke, but was it any good? What did you think of it?
Well, I wore it for a bit, you know, when I got home. And
was it reasonable quality? Or
well, it wasn't bad. It did its trick for the first few months I was in semi seat. So, yeah, not bad, I suppose.
And what sort of financial bonus did you get?
I finally got the £75 that was owing to me from the completion of my 3 years extended service, and confirmed that I could keep the £25 I'd been paid before. So I went home with about £100, I suppose.
Which is quite a lot, then.
Oh, quite a lot of money, yes, yes.
Now, what were you going to do? Because, you know, it's always this thing, isn't it? You get the end. You'd been in quite a long time by then.
Yes, that's right.
What were you going to do?
No idea. Coming back on the from Leon Solent on the train, I met a bloke who said he was he got a contract for looking at the asbestos in ships' engine rooms. Would I like to take that job on? So I said, "Oh, sounds interesting. What can I do?" So he said, "Well, what you have to do," he said, "I'd pay you £5 an hour, and you'd go round And anywhere that needed duffing up in the engine room with asbestos, you'd put it right. So I said, well, I'll think about it. I said, give me your address. And he said, I've got an office in London. He said, come and see me when you're ready. Well, after about a fortnight, I thought, well, I'd better do something about finding some employment. So I went to see this bloke, and he seemed strangely reluctant to see me. And I found out later on that he was only in the throes of negotiating a contract, hadn't really got a contract at all, and really hadn't got any work at that time. So I said, well, cheerio, thank you very much, and I'll think about it. And from that day to this, I've never seen him. And from what I've heard about asbestos in the engine room since, I'm very glad I didn't. Yeah.
Now, what were you going to do? Because you'd worked in a light engineering factory, hadn't you, on a lathe?
Yes.
Now, what were you going to do? I mean, could you have gone back to that job, or was it too late?
Well, miles too late, really, because if I'd have been demobbed in my usual time, they'd have had to take me back for 6 months. But because I'd stayed on, I don't think they had that obligation, so I just cast myself adrift from any thought of going back there. So the first thing I did was I went to the the Soldiers, Sailors and Air Force Institute. I said, what do you advise me to do? He said, well, he said, until you get settled down, he said, I would advise you to take on a job that I've got an offer that you can start straight away. I can promise you can start straight away. I'll give you the address of this bloke. And fortunately, he was in the Haymarket in Southwest One. And my wife was living at home with her parents in West One, only about a quarter of an hour's walk away. And so I thought, well, I'll walk round there and see what this bloke's got to offer. So I went round to see this bloke. His name was Joel, and he was trying to start up a connection with Kemp's Directory after the war. Kemp's Directory for various firms had fallen into disuse over the war, and he, together with a few others, was trying to restart it and get some money by getting money from advertising for these various clients. So he had a staff of people who used to go around and see these people that they got the addresses from for the old Kemp's Directory. They'd go around and
Kemp's
Kemp's Directory. There were several others that was in competition at the time, I hasten to add.
So did you take this job?
Yeah, but not in the category he wanted me to take it in. He wanted me to go round and start getting advertisements from these old clients on commission. I said, I don't want to do that. I'd rather have something with a more settled income, if you don't mind. So he said, well, what you can do is come into our office, he said, and prepare slips. What we do, we're cutting up the old Kemp's Directory. There were hundreds of pages of the blooming thing with loads of adverts of various sizes. He said, what you can do is paste these onto our prepared slips and hand them over to the advertisement seekers and let them get on with it. So for some time, I sat in his office cutting up the old Kemp's Directory and preparing these slips and passing them over. But after well over 5 years, it seemed...
5 years?
Well, the old Kemp's Directory had fallen by the wayside during the war, you see. But they, in competition with other directories, the Miss Kelly's Directory as well, they were trying to get going again.
Hang on, you did this for 5 years?
No. The directory had fallen into disuse.
So what happens next? Did you stay with them, or what happened?
Well, I stayed with them until I saw an advert in the Evening News.